live on air, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Good evening and welcome. Nice to have your company again on this Monday evening for another edition of the Irish programme live on air. I do hope you've had a good week since we last met, and the next hour or so will be filled with all things nice, all things Irish as well. Now, last week, if you were listening, you will recall that I had mentioned at the start of the programme that I would be talking to Manus Walsh, and unfortunately Manus was unable to join us throughout the programme. However, to make sure that didn't happen again, I went to see him during the week. So I'm absolutely certain that we have an interview with Manus Walsh this evening. I also met with a man by the name of Des Kenny, and Des is one of the Kennys that operates the world famous Kenny's bookstore and gallery in Galway. I had a lovely chat with Des, and they're the two interviews that you're going to hear this week on the programme. Both of them are a little longer than you normally would hear. There will be no Brexit piece with Peter O'Dwyer today, and the reason for that is very simple. There has been so much happening in relation to Brexit over the last week. The whole world knows what the British reaction, what the European reaction, what the Irish reaction is. And we always try and focus just on the Irish and bring you something that you may or may not have heard. So we just thought you might have had enough of it this week. Don't forget, we have a brand new email address. If you would like to get in touch with me for any reason for the programme, well, my email address is ger@tre.radio. Sometimes we like to look at famous birthdays, and today we're going to do that. Normally there is a musical one in there, but there isn't this week, but that's okay. And would you believe it, there are four birthdays I think you should be aware of, and all four of them are happening on this Wednesday, which is the 21st of November. On that day, we mark the birth of Joseph Mary Plunkett in Dublin. Joseph Mary Plunkett was one of the leaders of the 1916 Easter Rising. He was also a very accomplished writer. He was born on that day in 1887. Neil Tobin, actor and comedian, was born in Cork in 1929. So on Wednesday, he turns 89 years of age. And what a fabulous age that is. Eddie O'Sullivan, former Irish rugby coach, was born in Cork as well in 1958. He's 60 years old on Wednesday. And Eamon Coughlan, the middle distance runner, born in Dublin in 1952. We say happy 66th birthday to Eamon Coughlan. So what are we going to do for music? Well, I thought we'd visit the Eurovision Song Contest again, and let's go to 1979. The Eurovision Song Contest was held in Jerusalem on the 31st of March. It was the 24th edition of the Eurovision Song Contest, and the winner was again Israel with a song called Hallelujah. It was sung by Gali Atari and Milk and Honey. I remember that, to be honest. There were 19 entries that year, and Ireland sent a man from Cork by the name of Cathal Dunn, and he sang a song called Happy Man. He came fifth with 80 points on the night. Cathal Dunn gathered a good following in Ireland, but shortly after appearing for Ireland in the Eurovision, he moved to America, where he still is and still sings. So we wish him well, Cathal Dunn. So anyway, let's take a listen to it. Our Eurovision memory from 1979, Cathal Dunn, and the Irish entry, Happy Man. On Live on Era, on Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.
this love I'm feeling inside. Girl, you've made me a happy man, and I will share a lifetime with you, making our dreams all come true. Now I can smile.
Entry into the 1979 Eurovision Song Contest in Israel. That was Cathal Dunn and a song called Happy Man. Gonna take a very quick break and come back to me just after that, and I'll be talking to Manus Walsh.
Ger Sweeney presenting live on Era.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, on the 10th of November, I went along to Kenny's Gallery in Galway because Manus Walsh was opening a brand new exhibition called Variations. And I had it on my list to talk to Manus. And when I rang him to talk to him for the program, he said, actually, I have an exhibition coming up. Would you come along to the opening? So I did. And it was absolutely fantastic. There were 40 wonderful pieces on display there. I didn't manage to catch up with Manus to talk to him, to interview him, because he was just way too busy. And I knew that. So we had agreed that we'd do a phone call. Anyway, that didn't happen last week on the programme. But I did get to meet with Morris throughout the week last week, and I sat with him in his studio in Ballyvaughan. And the exhibition was the first thing that we spoke about. It was opened by Rose Hines, who is the chairperson of the Shannon Group. I began, when I met Manus last week, talking about the exhibition and about some of the comments that Rose Hines made on the day. She said that you'd been in the Burren for 40 years, and the Burren had been a huge influence on you, but you too had been a huge influence on the Burren. And indeed, she described Ballyvaughan and the area around Ballyvaughan as a hub for culture. Mm-hmm. And said that Manus Walsh was partly and more than likely hugely responsible for that. What do you think of a remark like that?
It's very complimentary, but I just see myself as working away quite normally in Ballyvaughan, having been here for 42 years. I don't think of myself as that. You know, I'm just a working artist who lives here, basically. So it was very flattering and very nice, but I don't see myself as that, you know, some that would influence culture or whatever.
In relation to the exhibition itself, it is titled Variations, and it's in place until early December in Kenny's in Galway. And we'll talk more about that in a few moments. It's called Variations. What does the Variations title refer to?
Well, it covers my career over the various things I've done, over them using various materials, starting with stained glass, then painting solo, you know, going full-time painting back in the 60s on the advice of George Campbell. And then I taught myself enamelling, because we had a craft workshop here in Ballyvaughan, so I was able to do the crafts and work on the spot. And so it's covering the career over all the various media, you know.
Okay. Really. And you had pieces there from your time in Spain and from Chile and various other places, but when you decide you're going to do an exhibition, do you set about working for that exhibition exclusively, or are there pieces already that you would have made or painted that you think I'd include those?
Well, I'd always have something going at the time, but it concentrates the mind in that you have a deadline and you have to have a number of pieces. So I'd work towards that, but I'd give myself plenty of time, because it takes a good bit of time to produce a painting or to paint or whatever. and go from there. But overall, I'd start months and months beforehand. You know, this one would, there's so much in it and there's so many different media that it mostly took the whole year. So you'd want to think of that, you know. But it's a question of discipline too. I'm fairly regular in my work practice. I'd go to work in the morning and work for so many hours, and you have to be quite disciplined.
And is it like writing? Do you often stare at a blank canvas and think, what am I going to do? Or do you just start and work from there? Are there times when you need some bit of inspiration, or is it always there?
No, you just get to work straight away with the blank sheet. I wouldn't be staring at it for too long. I'd get stuck into it immediately and hope that it will evolve into something worthwhile. Or many times I've said, this isn't working. I'm sure most artists are the same with the musician composing or whatever. I go over and over it and maybe even cover the... I've covered an entire painting and started again, you know. So that comes into it as well.
And how did you get into painting? You weren't always a full-time painter, I know, because you mentioned that you came to the Burren over 40 years ago to work in Gregan's Castle. So where did it all come from?
It came from meeting George Campbell in the stained glass when I was an apprentice in the Abbey Studios in Dublin, which is a very well-known, it's still there actually, very well-known stained glass studios. George Campbell came in, he was quite a big name, and he came in as designing it for stained glass, but he knew nothing about the actual craft of stained glass. So myself and George Walsh, who's one of the best stained glass artists in the country, he was no relation, but we helped George out, you know, and I got to know him then and found that he went to Spain and he had this, and I had this thing about flamenco music. I don't know where it came from. So at the end, we got to know him anyway very, very well, and he encouraged me to go solo and gave me my first exhibition, and he gave me a Spanish guitar in appreciation of the help we'd given him, you know, in the stained glass studios. And then I went down with his encouragement. I went down to Spain on the train, completely naive, just landed in the bar. The La Buena Sombra was the bar in Malaga that he frequented and gathered people around him, you know. So it was a huge learning curve for me.
The more and more I hear about George Campbell and the more people I meet that came into contact with him, he was a very large figure, obviously, and he was hugely influential. As a man, was he very warm? Was he very... did he take people under his wing? How would you describe him?
Oh, yeah, very much so. If he saw any spark of creativity or painting or whatever it might be, he encouraged old and young. And that's how he got to know. That's how I got to know him, really. And wherever he was, he gathered people around him. He was very sociable, loved the old nights out, fantastic music sessions, both in his house and wherever he went. He had a place in Virginia. The minute he got there, he seemed to have gathered musicians around him, you know, and the same in Spain with... He played flamenco guitar very well.
Wherever I go and talk about George Campbell in Spain, people talk about Armstrong, and they also mention Walsh, you being the Walsh. What did George Campbell give you that, you know, helped you so much?
Well, it's a much overused term, but it was like the university. It was like a cliche, really, the university of life, because I was quite naive and came from a middle-class family in Stillorgan in Dublin, you know, so it's a huge eye-opener for me to go down to Spain and get to know all that, the crowd and Enrique and so on and so forth. You know, there was a big circle of people I got to know, and it was total eye-opener. And it went from there on. He was very musical, so he had a fantastic collection of records and LPs and got me into classical music. I was musical already in that I played the piano a bit, and we had a pop group and all that stuff back in the 60s. So it was he gave me a complete broadening of life, really, you know.
Where did he learn all this? I know he was born in Wicklow, moved to Belfast, and then later lived in Dublin. And what influenced him, do you know?
Well, I don't know, really. to be honest, because he kind of, he was self-taught as well, as like myself. And it seemed to be, it just fell into it. And I'm not sure, really, because I never spoke to him about the origins of his work or whatever. I just knew he was there and that he started painting quite young and did all kinds of other jobs in between to keep going, you know. So, and then just, he really got stuck into the work, you know. He was a worker in paint. He just, that's his method, you know, just go at it.
At what point in your life did you decide, that's it, I'm done with going out to work every day, I want to have a studio, I want to be a full-time painter? I know you would have been married, had a family. When did you do it? Why did you do it? Was it an easy decision?
Well, no, it wasn't. Again, it was a kind of, with the stained glass, from the stained glass and meeting George and his encouragement, it all stemmed from that. And then meeting people like George, or meeting Jerry Dillon and Arthur Armstrong were part of that group, and meeting them and in that circle. And that's encouragement, and just, you know, to get going and to get stuck in. And well, I always did work, various different types of work, because you're very hard to make a living as an artist, particularly in those days. So you did all kinds of other things.
And tell me about Spain. Your love affair with Spain obviously comes about because of the time you spent there with Jerry Dillon and Arthur Armstrong and with George Campbell as well. But how did that develop over the years, and where is it now?
I spent 2 months down there, which, as I said to you, was a complete eye-opener to me, a completely different culture. And Malaga in those days was very little tourism around there. And from there on, I went back again 2 years later for another 2 months. And it just seemed to have a connection, which I kept going. Now, when we got married and had kids and so on, time took its toll there, so we didn't have time, you know. But then when they were all grown up and had more time, I started going back there again. And we went on, we have a small group of like-minded people. We went cycling in all over Spain as well and other places. But I kept the connection up, and it's kind of deepened since then, you know. So I keep going back.
Where do you draw inspiration from? I know the Burren obviously would be huge inspiration for you, but looking at the paintings at the Kenny Gallery last week, there is a lot more that you get inspired by.
Yeah, well, the Spanish connection again, and all the travels I've done in Spain, and especially around Andalusia. You'll see them here in my little studio here. And also Chile, where I went and stayed for a month or so with friends of mine there, and I fell in love with the Chilean people and the landscape. It's a fascinating country, and especially Valparaiso, which I've done a lot of work on, and that's been an influence. Anywhere I've travelled, really, I've picked up a bit of inspiration, but it's mostly Spain, and the Burren would be the main influence.
And when you're in Spain, what do you like to do? How do you pass your time apart from painting? And is part of your downtime looking around and thinking about painting?
Well, I'm really just transfer my living space to Spain when I go there and live just as I do here. And the minute I get there, I more or less get to work. So it's just a completely different atmosphere, which I love. And the weather, of course, getting away for the dark days of winter here is a great help. And I just work away normally there and meet people I know there and so on and so forth. So I get a loan of a bicycle and cycle around the area and whatever, you know.
Lovely.
So, and I've stayed in all different places in Andalusia during the winter, in Compota, Salobreña, Almeria up in the mountains, and in Malaga itself, in Pedregaleco, which was George's old haunt. Well, in those days, it was a little fishing village, Pedregaleco, just on the east side of Malaga. It's all quite trendy now, but still very nice.
And when can the Spanish expect to see you back?
I'll be back on February the 9th, a bit later this year, because so it's hard to get a place, as the normal places I have were not available, so I'm slightly later, but shall be there for the couple of months anyway.
I suppose if you ask an artist this question, it might sound like a daft one, but I'm going to ask it anyway. When you say that you're fairly disciplined with your work and you do a day's work in your studio, is it something that you can relax on or relax with, or is there stress involved with it?
Well, there's always a stress of, is the creative thing going to run out? So you're never quite sure till you get well into the painting that this is working or this is going well or whatever. Well, it's a beautiful area and all the family are here as well, so that keeps me occupied, as they say. I like cycling. I used to do a lot of walking because of back problems. I'm not able to walk so much, but I do a lot of cycling and around Spain as well. So that's a hobby. I play music as well, so I play the piano as well and play the organ here for the choir and that kind of thing. That's another part of the creative thing, you know.
I noticed at the gallery on last Saturday week when we were there that there were two paintings that featured mandolins. Have you a little soft spot for a mandolin?
No, it's like the Picasso thing, you know, with the mandolin and our Braque, you know, which I'd be slightly influenced by that kind of semi-abstract shapes. And they're nice shape, the guitar or the mandolin, or just a nice shape to add to it, really.
Okay. Have you ever stood on front of a canvas and started doing something and was working away at it and think, hang on, I've done this before?
That's one of the problems with the burn. To find new inspiration is always a problem. Not a problem, but it's something to be worked at and challenging. Is right. Yeah, it's very challenging actually. It's a challenging landscape because it's almost abstracted already with the stone, with the rocks and whatever the pavements. But I've gone into quite a lot of coastal work in the recent times, over the recent years. So that adds a new dimension to the work as well, you know. So hopefully I'll keep going anyway and find hopefully dig out a few more ideas and try new things and so on, you know.
You said you started out doing stained glass and that was where the connection with George Campbell came. And behind me here in your studio there are two lovely pieces. One of them is one of the stained glass windows that you've done in Galway Cathedral, and one of them is one that's done in the church here in Ballyvaughan. Will you talk to me about those?
Yeah. Well, when I was working in the Abbey Studios, the famous Bishop Brown of Galway was trying to find various artists to do stained glass, to do the designs, and I was picked out for that. I think it was kind of influenced by the fact that my grandfather was very famous in his day, Maurice Walsh, who wrote many, many books and was a big name in his day. He did the Quiet Man from what the film was made, but it was a short story. So that's where I got that he wanted me to do a design. Bishop Brown wanted me to do a design of the Last Supper. And that's that one there. But there were four others as well, which are up in the clear story of different themes. So there's five altogether. Then there's two stained glass pieces here in the church. One was the Michael Green Memorial, which is window. But Michael Green was a local man who had Highlands Hotel. But then when he got married, himself and Mary Hawkes Green founded the Byrne College of Art, which is that beautiful College of Art, just a couple of miles from the village here. So that was a lovely commission to get, to do a memorial window for Michael. And then just a couple of years ago, just 2 years this coming up this Christmas, I think, the design for the triptych window at the back of the church, which is the new one. And that was based on the encyclical of Pope Francis, Laudato Si, on the environment. So I tried to put in various aspects of the burn, Genesis, the creation, and the environment, so it's all encompassed in that window, hopefully.
Let's talk more a little bit about the exhibition. It started last Saturday week and it runs for just under a month. It closes sometime around the 5th of December or thereabouts. You can see pieces online as well, can't you, from that?
Yes, you can get the whole exhibition is on the kennygallery.ie, and the whole whatever it is, 40 pieces can be seen on that website. And hopefully it'll be many more to come.
Manus, you have a website yourself that gives a little bit of background on who you are and the type of work that you do. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's just manuswalsh.com. And various pieces of my work are on that, and the history of my biography and CV and so on. So it's all on that website. I have another exhibition planned for September next year in the Kilcock Gallery, which George formally opened, you know, in 1979, I think it was. 78, 79, yeah.
We spoke to Breda actually about that, because when I did a piece with Carlos in relation to George Campbell, it linked in very nicely. Talk to me about Carlos, because we did speak to Carlos about George Campbell. Yes. And he and you were very close in Spain.
Yeah. Well, Carlos has been a fantastic help to me and encouragement to me in Spain. It was through his father, really, Enrique Perez Almeida, who was part of the George Campbell group there. And Carlos would have been very young at that time, but we kept up connections, and he's a great friend, and he's done a wonderful amount of work for me over the years with the exhibitions I've had in Spain and so on, you know. So I keep up that connection. I have a family. I can say I have a family, second family in Spain, yeah.
Any plans to exhibit again in Spain?
Well, not at the moment, because I'm with this big exhibition now and the one next year. All is open to suggestions, as they say.
All right. Well, listen, it's been lovely talking to you, and it's even been nicer talking to you in the surroundings in which we are, looking at and enjoying your own work. We wish you many more years of creativity, and let's hope it doesn't run out, as you say yourself. And thank you for talking to us, Manus Walsh.
Thanks very much, Ger. Thank you very much.
Ger Sweeney presenting Live on Era.
Welcome back to the programme. History is a very important part of culture in Ireland, indeed all cultures. And every so often we like to look back at the week that was many years ago in Irish history. Starting with today, the 19th of November, it was back in 1798 that Theobald Wolfetone died from a stab wound to his neck, which he inflicted upon himself on November the 12th. His attempted suicide is the result of being refused a soldier's execution by firing squad and being sentenced to death by hanging. Tomorrow, Tuesday the 20th of November, we go back as far as 2001. A cash-strapped Aer Lingus auctioned its collection of paintings. Most money went on By Merrion Strand by Jack B. Yeats, an oil on canvas which was sold for £290,000 at the time, so that would be well in excess of €300,000 in today's money. Wednesday, the 21st of November, back in 1920, on the morning of this date, 14 British intelligence officers were shot dead in Dublin by Michael Collins's men in the afternoon at a GAA match in Croke Park in Dublin. Between Tipperary and Dublin, 12 civilians, including one of the players, died after the Black and Tans opened fire. The auxiliaries killed 3 prisoners, including 2 IRA men in Dublin that night, and the date became infamously known as Bloody Sunday, the first of the Bloody Sundays. 1974, on the 21st of November, bombs believed planted by the Provisional IRA devastated 2 central Birmingham pubs, killing 19 people and injuring just over 180. On Thursday, the 22nd of November, as a result of the pub bombings, Hugh Callaghan, Patrick Hill, Robert Hunter, Noel McElkenny, William Power and John Walker, who became known as the Birmingham Six, were charged in connection with the pub bombings, which took place earlier in the week. Saturday the 24th of this week, 1942, the death of Padraig Kearney. Who's Padraig Kearney, you might ask? He was the man that composed, he wrote, the Irish National Anthem, a soldier song. 1972, on that day, the RTE authority was replaced by the government after RTE broadcasted a radio interview with the IRA leader, Sean McStiafon. 1982, general election in the Republic led to a Fine Gael Labour coalition government. And in 2002, on the 24th of November, Ireland's TDs and senators lose 3-2 to their Scottish counterparts in a friendly football match. It was called the Clash of the Celts, and it was the inter-parliamentary match which was held to highlight the Irish-Scottish bid to host the Euro 2008 football championships. Just some of the events that happened this week in history in Ireland. Here's a group of lads: Ryan Hennessy, Jimmy Rainsford, Owen Cardiff and Cliff Dean. You put the four lads together, you get a fabulous group that's been together since about 2015. They call themselves Picture This. Here's a song from them called One Drink on Live on Era, the Irish programme on Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.
You were the best thing, and I was so invested in And I need you to tell me that you're not too far gone. And I should've learned my lesson when you heard that I was texting, hurting all my exes. But now you're too far gone, and I'll be here, arms open, but you made it clear that you're not coming. So I need more than one drink to get over you. And I know it's not the right way to cope, but I don't know how to handle my emotions. One drink to get over you. And I know that I've regret it in the morning. It's the bottle, not my heart, that I've been pouring, yeah. Before I'm too far gone, can't stop looking at the pictures that we took when I was with you. Yeah, we had something special, but now you're too far gone. And I'll be here, arms open, but you made it clear that you're not coming. So I need more than one drink to get over. It's not the right way to cope, but I don't know how to handle my emotions. One drink to get over you. And I know that I've regretted in the morning. It's the bottle, not my heart, that I've been pouring, yeah. Get over you. And I know it's not the right way to cope, but I don't know how to handle my emotions. One drink to get over you. And I know that I've repented in the morning. It's the bottle, not my heart, that I've been pouring, yeah.
Great song from Picture This. It's called One Drink. I'm going to take a very quick break. Come back to me just after that, and I'll be talking to Des Kenny from Kenny's Bookshop in Galway.
Ger Sweeney presenting Live on Era.
Welcome to the final part of the programme. As I told you, I was in Galway, and it was a great opportunity to meet the Kenny family and talk to them about the history of the world-renowned Kenny bookstore. And again, like Manus's interview, I've done very little editing of it because it's a great story and Des tells it so well. And I started by asking Des Kenny a little bit about the history of the bookstore, and I knew it was his mum and dad that had started it, so we started right there.
The bookshop really started by a chance meeting. My mother was in County Leitrim, Mohill County Leitrim. She was born and bred, and I won a scholarship here to NUIG or UCG, or the Uni as it was known at the time. And her first day going to college, she was just beginning to walk up St. Mary's Road. When out of Rally Row, this gentleman came. He came across the road, said hello, and that they claimed for the rest of their lives was simply that. 4 years later, they got married, and they both graduated from college. There was a war on. They didn't want to leave Galway anyway, but there were no jobs. And my father, as the story goes, went to one of his old teachers in the jazz here and asked his advice, and he suggested that they open a second-hand bookshop. And of course their eyes lit up. That was it. This is the magic. This is the magic wand. And to a degree it was, I suppose. They rented a small little room in High Street, which at that time was very, very few people going up and down it. I think the rent was something like 10 and 6 a week or something like that. 10 shillings and sixpence, which is kind of less than 50 cents of euro at the moment. They had no money, hadn't a penny between them, but they managed somehow or other to stock it. They managed to get books from their friends, etc., etc. God only knows where they got them from, but they did. My father could be a little bit of a scavenger that way, that he could get things when they didn't appear to be there. In fact, when the shop first opened on the 29th of November 1940, and the weeks thereafter, and the people who got, we were coming in out of pure curiosity to see what this new shop was, there were people who looked at the shelves and said, "It's curious. Last time I saw that book, that was in my sitting room."
Right.
They actually lived behind the shop. To create more money, they started a lending library, and that kind of helped out a little bit as well. Either which way, my older brother Tom was born, and he was born into High Street, and there followed five of us. After Thomas was born, my parents found a house, and again, God knows how they bought it, but they did, out in Salt Hill, where we lived all our lives until about 10 years ago. The shop began to kind of grow a little bit. The shop wasn't making enough, though, as there were six of us in it, and we were cold and we were hungry, and we let them know it. So my father had to go elsewhere to work to make up enough wage to keep that going. But he never really left the shop. The shop was part and parcel, not just of them, but of us. It became inside our blood. So when I tell people that, who ask me, when did I start selling books, and I say before I was born, they think I'm joking. I actually haven't. We grew up in a crazy house. It was absolutely fabulous. It was lively, people coming in and out all the time, writers, artists, what have you, sitting to dinner, parties. My parents would have a party at the drop of a hat. Very, very liberal, although they were deeply religious and both Catholic, both deeply Catholic. Daily mass goers and all the rest of it. They never interfered in what we were doing or saying. The books became part of us, if you know what I mean. Of the six of us, five still work in the bookshop. At the sixth, my sister is a teacher and a psychologist. I was extremely lucky. Came out of Leaving Cert in 67, went to college here, did an arts degree, was extremely lucky to get a grant to go to Paris for 3 years. So I was in the Sorbonne for 3 years, and from 70 to 73, and it was out there really that I had inclinations towards an academic life. It was in Paris where I suddenly got this almost Saul-like moment, and I decided I was going to become a bookseller.
How did it go from being a small little shop like that in High Street in Galway to being recognised across the world as being one of the best bookstores in the world?
Thank you very much for saying that. But anyway, it was a kind of a very slow, almost an evolutionary sort of movement. My father would go up country and he'd come back, even when he was not working in the bookshop, and he'd have just a car full of books, and we'd end up sorting them, putting them on shelves and all the rest of it. And then eventually the business he was in, he was personal manager of a cotton factory here in Galway, they wanted us to move to Manchester. And at that stage, we were far too much part of Galway. Galway was far too much part of us. So he left the job. So he decided he would take the marketing skills he had learned in the other job and bring them to bear in the shop. And he started to do catalogues and send them out. That really was the first, or one of our first exercises in marketing. The other one was more almost personal than that, in that during the winter or during the spring months, every night my mother, who had a beautiful, beautiful writing hand, used to write these little lovely little postcards, what to do on a rainy day, go to a bookshop, or come to Kenny's bookshops. And we used to have to go to all the bed and breakfasts in town and leave them in, and ask them would they put them in the rooms. And because they knew us, they did. And that brought a certain amount of customers. And we, from the very, very beginning, we were learning all this. We were learning how to sort books. We were learning how to catalogue books. We were learning all about books. And it was with the catalogues we started to discover that there was a massive interest abroad in things Irish. I suppose we were talking about the mid-60s now. This is before the big surge started. The first big surge of Irish enterprise abroad really started about then. And there was a buoyancy in the air. And we became part of that buoyancy, if you like. Plus the fact that the laws on censorship began to weaken. As they weakened, it allowed a whole spate of new Irish publishers to come on the scene. And we knew the publishers, we knew all their problems, we knew what they had to do with. And because of that, we were able to become part of that movement, if you like, in a strange sort of way. And we would have introduced these writers through catalogues to readers all over the world, including libraries. I mean, I remember those catalogues, Tom. We had a kind of one of those machines that you duplicated with. And he used to print the machines up in his bedroom upstairs, and the language coming out of that room, while that was going on, was something else. And he came out of the place all Lincoln and everything. And those pages, when they were finished, were taken down to the dining room table, where they were collated by us at the dining room table, stapled on the dining room table. We got the envelopes, we addressed the envelopes, stamped the envelopes ourselves, brought them up to the post office. It was a pain in the ass. When we knew a catalogue was nearing fruition, we always tried to make ourselves scarce. My father had this method of knowing where we were and how we were and what we were, and bang, we were back in there doing it all again. That kind of humdrum work was hugely rewarded when we saw orders coming from California, Los Angeles, Hollywood. We saw them come from New Orleans. We saw them come from Japanese stamps coming in with orders, German stamps coming in with orders. And this whole thing suddenly opened up a whole new international world. And indeed, gave us a cosmic culture, if you like, when very few other people had it in Ireland. And I suppose that educated us, and that became part of our makeup as well.
Now, the catalogue obviously was a precursor to the type of thing that you get on the internet. And the internet must have brought for you mixed blessings, because you can buy a book anywhere in the world online right now. But it also meant that you didn't have to be stapling the catalogues at the kitchen table, is that you could put your catalogue once online and the world saw it. So was it a kind of a plus and a minus for you?
Well, to begin with, it was a plus. We were the second bookshop in the world to have a website. How that happened was that digital had closed down here in Galway. At that stage, no, we had a fairly good international reputation. And from 1980 on, we became the vendors to the Library of Congress in Washington, which means we have supplied Library of Congress with every new book published in Ireland since 1980 on a proof of plan basis. And that opened up a whole new idea to us that was established more, even more, in 1986, when we made our first trip during the Depression of the 80s. Our backs were seriously to the wall, and my brother Connor, who was a thinker in the family, said, there's only one way out, we have to go to the States. So literally on a wing and a prayer, my father and Connor, my youngest brother, flew out in April 1986, just before Easter, I remember. When they came back, life had changed completely for us. I remember distinctly getting a phone call from Connor. To take the phone call, I had to go into work on Easter Monday morning. There was no bank holiday in the States. And when Connor came on the phone, I thought he was drunk.
Right.
What I hadn't realised is just the air in hotel rooms, what they can do to your voice, you know, the dry heat and whatever. And when he asked me to do what he wanted me to do, I thought he was even really plastered. And what really scared me, how can he do that? He's sharing the room with Dad, how can he do that? You know? What he was asking me to do was, he wanted me to send two invoices to Boston Public Libraries, one for $14,000, one for $8,000. That was mega bucks for us. I said, but I can't send the invoices. I haven't sent any books. Send the invoices. I can't send. We got to a row. But I sent them at the end. What happened was, they had called into Boston Public Libraries because of a chance meeting or a chance phone call the night before they left Ireland. The man in charge there, they at that stage wanted to set up an approval plan with Ireland. One was what they called the popular approval plan, the other one was the academic approval plan, hence the two different amounts of money. But their budget year was coming to an end, and they had surplus in their budget. They had to get it out. That's why they wanted the invoices first. After that, we always travelled with invoices. And because we went out there, we went to the States and travelled there, and went around to the various cities, we began to realise that there was a huge, massive, massive market abroad, not just of Irish expats, but also of American people themselves. We wanted to know more about this culture and about this literature. And that even opened up more vistas to us. We began to put together collections of, let's say, labour-related books or church-related books or whatever, and send those as collections. And then there was another element. We came to realise that our personal knowledge itself was a scarce commodity in terms of books abroad. And because of our upbringing, if you like, our knowledge of the book world was intense, was almost intimate. I remember one day, this guy walked into the shop. He smiled at my mother, and my mother smiled at him when she smiled at everybody. And he nodded the head and he said, same again. And my mother said, same again. And what that meant was that I'm at the end of my trip. This is before credit cards have become as used as often as they are now, or as readily as they are now. And what that meant was that he had come to the end of his holiday. He used up all his cash. He wanted to buy books. Could he pay when he got his first paycheck when he went back? We sent books out in approval anyway, so there was no big deal. Of course you can, yeah, no problem. Anyway, this particular day he came in and he started looking at the shelves, and all of a sudden he started to curse and swear, and out loud. I mean, he did seriously start to curse and swear. I got a fright. I said, Jesus, what's he doing? And my mother, of course, being my mother, went into selective deafness and dived behind the counter. And I kind of came out and I a little bit frightened coming out, because this was a big man and I am not a person who's been in many fights in my life at all. I said, excuse me, sir, did we do something to you? It's not you, he said. And I says, well, can you tell us what it is? Might be able to alleviate your pain. Mm-hmm. It drives me nuts. What drives you nuts? I come into your shop and I see all these Irish books, all these wonderful Irish writers, and I want to bring them all home and I can't. I live in Boston, no books there. And they're all here and I can't bring them home. So my mother said, come on, she kind of resurrected herself from behind the counter. Yeah. But we'll send you a package ever so often. He turns his heel and he says, I can still see his smile. He says, you will? I said, sure, of course I will. I know what you like. I've seen you at the Shelms. I know exactly what you like him. You like him, you don't like her. And this, again, was part of the training coming through. And he says, gee. And he gave us the key. Here's my credit card number. And from that day on, for a number of years, every time I thought of him or a book came in that reminded me of him, I would put together a package of 4, 5, 6 other books similar that had been published since his last book lot and send them off. And that happened. And then there was one. And then there was two. And then there was three. And then there was four. Suddenly this idea began to kind of grow a little bit. These kind of little packages became more and more. One day this lady came in during the summer and she was French, so we started speaking in French. She was in Paris. She was teaching in a school called Charles Sanke, but she says, I'm teaching a course in women's studies in North of Ireland, but I can't get any books. I said, madame, le business is service, là, si vous voulez bien. And she said, wow. And so she signed up. She was the first person who signed up, and she signed on the back of a white used envelope. So for the next, I think it was 6 or 7 years, every 2 months I sent her 50, 60, 70 euros worth of books of the type that she wanted, the profile she gave me. That kind of grew and grew and grew, and then the digital closed down here, and which left a lot of people, technical people here, well educated people, but they didn't want to leave Galway. Galway has been known as a graveyard of promotions, and they just didn't want to leave. So they started these little companies all over Galway. And one day I went upstairs, and it was a lady who had working for us at the time, Maurice, who was our marketing lady, and Connor, my younger brother, and they were standing. There was a big, long, tall man standing with them, and on the desk, it was what I thought was a briefcase, and it was open. And I ran past it, and I looked at it, and I said, Jesus Christ, that's our shop. And he turned out that he was one of the guys who had worked at Digital. He started up Ireland.ie. He was looking for a flagship that would promote, and had a very good reputation abroad, that would promote his company. And he thought of us, and he came along, and made us an offer to go up a website. We said, of course we will, yeah, let's go. And we did. And the curious thing about that was that there was an innocence in those days that doesn't exist anymore. So what would happen at the first few times that the messages came through, of all people, I was the one who used to go up and take down the messages after a while. We had one computer. It was 4 floors up. You'd go up there once a day, maybe, you know. And I go up and I get somebody who'd send me an email saying, hey, geez, great to see you on email. Great to see Kenny's are going the world and all this rubbish. And then I want to get a load of books in 1916. So you go, oh, this is great. Like, I just got a load of cash and I want to buy. And like the idiot I was, I go downstairs, I get together about 20 good books, come upstairs, 4 floors with 20 books.
Yeah.
I put them down there, I'd list them and send them off and leave back. Just wait till the cash comes in now. Not a screed. Happened more time and time again. I said, okay, what I'm going to do from now on, if somebody calls and is interested in stuff, I'm going to ask them for their phone number. Right? If they give me the phone number, my foot's in the door. If they don't, they're not really interested. End of story. And it worked. It really worked. And suddenly, within a year, my book club jumped from 100 customers to 400 customers to 600 customers. That grew and grew, and I reached the point where I had something like 1,300 or 1,500 customers. And then it wasn't 9/11 that caused the crash. It was when the planes actually went into Iraq that the whole thing started to come down and started to cool. And then the Celtic Tiger was also cooling down. So, you know, people will now get more, like, they wanted the immediate thing, they wanted the internet experience, they could control it themselves. And that's when, as you rightly says, that became the bad side of it. But it had done us a huge amount of good. In the meantime, we started to learn really about what the internet was. It took us, actually, I think it was 1993, 1994, we had the website. It took us up to maybe 2005 to realise what exactly we needed to go to really get used to it. And that started from there. And that, I suppose, is one of the main reasons how this progressed. In the meantime, the gallery, during the 50s, my father and mother both felt that Irish artists were as good as any artist abroad, if not better. But there was no gallery in the west of Ireland, so they opened the first commercial gallery in our home in Saltin, in the west of Ireland. This is the way they were. They kept on the move all the time. We grew from there. Then we developed the gallery inside, developed the shop inside, and that became one building with two going onto two streets. And then eventually we realised that we were getting smothered inside. We were getting suffocated. I mean, we have 4 or 5 trucks come here every day, either delivering or taking books. We have big exhibitions coming in, such as the one you've just been to. Obviously, you couldn't deliver those in Middle Street. You wouldn't be able to. You know, and also people begin to see us as a place to go to, but they'd never buy there. And we needed money to pay to feed our kids, to pay our mortgages, to do all this. So we moved out here. And that was a big, big, big move. It was like losing a member of the family. Yeah. That's the basic story, I suppose.
Now you've got a smaller bookstore.
Oh, it's a bigger bookstore.
It's a bigger bookstore.
It's a bigger, better bookstore, yeah.
It's a bigger, better bookstore.
It's not as romantic as the other one was, right. But it's a bigger and better bookstore. You can see the books. The old place was all lovely little corners, twisty stairs and everything. Yeah. But try putting books in those shelves, man alive, it was a nightmare. Yeah. And then if somebody was looking at a shelf, nobody could even pass them. So out here, as you can see, the corridors are wide. There's about 275,000 books here. There are about 3.5 million books on our website. We try to replicate the experience of buying a book in a bookshop onto the website. Now, that's not easy. And we like to bring the person in touch. We want to keep the person in touch going. We want to, in other words, stop the buying of books as being something that you buy because you react to something. I want people to explore the world that they're coming into, to find something new that enriches them, either mentally or otherwise, in the books that they're reading, in the books that we pick, in the books that we can sell them. And the same with the art. I believe strongly in the whole idea of bookselling, what bookseller does, what a bookseller should do and should be. And for me, a bookseller proves himself or herself when somebody comes in for a book you don't have, but goes out with two that are better.
Right.
You know, and that really is bookselling at its best, or who can bring people into areas they never knew existed before. Again, that's bookselling. The same true of art. We open people's eyes, we open the vistas of their imagination, and that's really where we're at. That's what we try to do.
Great old passion in it. Absolutely brilliant. It's great to see it. Is there another generation behind you?
So far there are three of them in the business. But I'd say that could well be it, because a lot of others are settled at this stage, and they're, as it is, as it happens, strange enough, they're the younger ones of that generation. Tom's two are son and daughter involved. And my other brother, Jerry, who is our bookbinder, his daughter is involved in the bookbindery. And then that's as far as it's gone so far.
Where can we find you on the internet?
Kennys.ie.
And in Galway?
We're in the Lisbon Estate on the Tuam Road. That's a great thing. The parking is free. You don't have to face the traffic of mid-city Galway.
Would you have more customers that you've never seen than you would have customers you've seen?
Probably. Probably, yeah, because we deal with libraries, obviously, therefore we're not dealing with one person, we're dealing with the whole. And we also deal with people, of course. And word of mouth, of course, spreads all over the place. We never know where we're going to pop up, you know, or how we're going to pop up, which in a way is a good thing. I mean, there's no question about it. Publicity never did you any harm.
Des Kenny from Kenny's wonderful bookstore and gallery in Galway. Thank you for talking to me. It's a great story, and we wish you well in the future.
Okay, thank you.
I really enjoyed doing that interview with Des, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. That's my lot for today and for this week on the programme. I sincerely hope you have enjoyed what you have heard over the last 50 minutes or thereabouts. Look forward to being back with you again next Monday, just after the 6 o'clock news. Do join me, please, if you can. Can I say thank you to my colleagues here at Talk Radio Europe for their constant support by way of promoting the programme and supporting it in various other ways. Thank you as well to our cultural correspondent, our Spanish-Irish cultural correspondent, Jose Antonio Sierra. If you've missed some of the programme, you can listen back to it on our Listen Back facility. Just go to our website, Talk Radio Europe. Look after yourselves in the next week. Bye-bye now.
Ger Sweeney presenting Live on Era.